From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
What's your composting setup? Bin or tumbler, open pile, or maybe even an ingenious set of three pits in the ground? And most important, how is it working? More effective composting tactics, along with other timely advice to prepare for spring, is the subject of today's show with New York Botanical Garden instructor Daryl Byers. But first, this message.
Programming and underwriting support from Brushwood Nursery. For more than 20 years, Brushwood Nursery has shipped the finest selection of clematis and other vines all over the United States with full gallon-sized plant and free shipping. Their website is full of beautiful pictures and information on growing clematis. Brushwoodnursery.com.
The popular course that Daryl Byers teaches at the New York Botanical Garden in New York City is called Fundamentals of Gardening. And now Daryl, who has more than 25 years of professional landscaping experience besides his teaching role, has put all the fundamentals into a new book, The New Gardener's Handbook. It was in its pages that I picked up some new-to-me tips on better composting and more. Welcome, Daryl. I can't wait to hear about more about this. I'm excited.
Hi, Margaret. It's great to be with you.
Yeah. So for a number of years, you've taught the Fundamentals of Gardening course, I just said it, NYBG.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
oh yeah.
I wonder if in that class, as in the intro to the New Gardener's Handbook, whether you also tell students when they're beginning that UC gardening is part art and part science, which I totally agree with, by the way.
I do. Within the first 10 minutes, the way that I'm trying to explain things to my new gardening students, and the same, and sort of the same reason why I talk about it in the introduction of the New Gardener's Handbook, is the idea that gardening isn't just science, but it's also not just guessing. And so there's a combination of strategies that you have to kind of put together. And what I try to do is build people's confidence by giving them the background scientific information that they need to garden smart and to go out there and sort of feel comfortable and to have a good time with it. And what happens then is once you sort of understand what somebody once mentioned to me, it's the how do's of the why to's is sort of the thinking of it. I stole that from Joe Lample, who I talked to recently.
And love so Joe. Joe's a good friend. Yeah,
that was his line. I like to give credit to anybody who comes up with a good one. If you understand, you know, like the reasons why you're doing, you know, what people may have said that you should do to garden, what happens is you go out there and you become much more confident and you have a little bit more fun with it. And then basically what happens is you get better at it because you're doing it, because that's how you learn how to garden, is by doing it.
Yeah.
And so bringing the idea of the science and also the art and craft of it together is what, to me, makes a complete gardener and somebody who can, you know, get things done out in the garden and have fun with it too.
Yeah. So you want to help us develop our intuition by first giving us the knowledge, the solid knowledge.
Exactly. Yeah. I believe it's a fact, but maybe it's not, that we are all gardeners inside. We can all be a gardener. I mean, it's this genetic inheritance that we have, you know, and I think we really, if we tap into it, we can all do it. There's no such thing as a green thumb or no green thumb. I think everybody can do it. And so if you just want to do it and start connecting to nature in those ways, it'll work out for you. But you do need to have the basic science background to understand why you're doing what you're doing. I think that's what's important.
So before we get into composting and your amazing pit composting system, most of all, which I just totally loved, there were so many other ahas in the book. And even though I'm not a new gardener, I got a lot out of it, I want to say. Thank you.
Great.
And so I just wanted to ask you about a couple quickly that are kind of timely for people, because maybe it'll help them too. It's almost time when, or in the southern states, it's already time when people are transplanting, especially trees and shrubs. And I loved seeing that when you're transplanting, you've dug a hole for a new tree or shrub, and you've maybe taken it out of its ball and burlap or out of its pot or nursery pot, and you're putting it in the hole, you don't fill that hole completely and then stomp on it with your foot and then water it.
Right.
Tell us the right order of things.
You're supposed to dig the hole and get the plant and say, and basically digging the right size of hole depending on the size of the root ball and getting the crown of the plant at grade level or the root flare of the tree at grade level. And then you put the plant in the root ball inside of the hole, and that's when it's time to water.
I make the distinction between
the way that a landscaper plants a plant and the way that a gardener plants a plant.
Yes.
A gardener plants a plant by watering that root ball in. The landscaper is the person that throws the soil down, stomps around it a bunch of times, and then says, okay, on to the next one. And then they're just sort of doing it to finish the job and go home and do something different. Whereas the gardener is doing it knowing that this is a long-term prospect. I need to get this thing established the right way. And by watering the root ball before you fill in all the backfill soil, you are ensuring that the root zone of that root ball is nice and moist all the way around and all the way through. And that's the main reason why people lose new plants is because the root ball dries out.
Yeah.
And so that's the first really good.
I'd say that landscaper that you talked about, and not all people who are landscapers do this, but a lot of some companies install plants. They don't plant plants, right?
Right.
They install them.
Yeah, there's a difference between like trying to bust out a planting and going out there and planting a garden.
Yes.
It's a very different. It's a different approach.
And I think of what you do. I used to call it puddling it in. It's like gradually making sure that all those layers of that hole, especially the bottom where the roots are, you're going to encourage them to go, are nice and moist and inviting. So that I loved that because I think so many people do it wrong. I also loved a pruning sort of insight that I hadn't really thought about. I guess I need to take a proper pruning class. But where you discussed what you could infer from the where a trunk and a limb, a branch of a tree come together, the crotch, the so-called crotch, and whether it was V-shaped, tighter, or U-shaped, and how close to 90 degrees. You say the closer the crotch angle to 90 degrees, the more trustworthy the limb when you're trying to decide which ones are good and going to grow well and be useful to the structure of the tree or not. The ones closer to 90 degrees, the more trustworthy. Explain that to us.
Yeah. So, you know, every tree will have a different, you know, slightly different kind of crotching pattern, I suppose, as far as like that U-shaped versus that V, the V-shaped.
Yeah.
And I learned this from an arboriculturalist years ago.
Not Wayne K. Hilly.
Say that again.
Wasn't Wayne K. Hilly at the New York Botanical Garden, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was somebody that was trying to get involved on the estate where I was working.
Oh,
and
So he
decided to give me a really good lesson.
Good.
And we brought him in because he knew his stuff. And basically what's going on there is with the U-shaped crotch, if you take a close look at it, you can see how there's a lot more wood, sort of wood mass, to hold the limb in place. The V-shaped crotch has a lot less sort of volume of wood to hold, to keep that limb safe. And so that's the limb that's more likely to crack and to break if it has too much weight out on the extension of it. It's just a weaker setup, that tight V-shaped crotch. When you're looking at it, if you're looking to prune a tree and you have a potential crossing branch or you want to open up the canopy of a tree and do some thinning cuts or something like that, and maybe there's a limb that you want to remove, you would always choose between the U-shaped crotch versus the slightly more V-shaped crotch. In other words, the more acute the angle is, that would be the candidate to remove. And you can do the same thing when you're selecting a tree, like especially, you know, this time of the year, if you start looking at trees to purchase, the leaves aren't on there yet. You can see the branching structure and you can see what's going to happen in the future. And you pick the tree that has more U-shaped crotches and fewer V-shaped crotches, and you know that you're going to have a tree that's going to last
a stronger architecture innately.
Exactly. If it's an oak tree with really strong wood and I have U-shaped crotches and the branch is going over, you know, even if it's going over a structure, a house of some sort, I trust that limb.
Mm-hmm.
I trust
it. Mm-hmm.
If the tree is healthy otherwise, I will trust that limb.
So also about woody plants, there was a tip about rejuvenating shrubs, and not all shrubs respond to the same treatment. And, you know, this is a time when early spring, when things are just about to wake up and have a lot of energy, that a lot of times we can do some serious pruning or some rejuvenation pruning. And I was interested that you tell some different reasons why We might do it over several years, like take out one-third of the oldest stems of the shrub every year for 3 years, kind of the traditional wisdom of rejuvenating over several years versus just hack the baby down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mostly it's a matter of, like, you know, the shock to your system when you look at that shrub being completely gone. And that's
right.
That's really one of the main reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's aesthetics. And so, you know, it's one of the main reasons why I would do a multi-year rejuvenation prune. And
right.
it could be 2 years, it could be 3 years, it could be 4 years, and you just take off a corresponding percentage of the limbs each time. One nice thing about going slowly is that what happens is each year as the new growth comes in, you're able to assess it and prune
yes.
it and shape it the way that you want. And so it's a little easier to kind of keep track of that when it's not all just coming up all at once. And so you can slowly kind of build the shrub back into a new form. But
right.
mostly it's people get shocked. You know, you have a 20-foot hedgerow of lilac bushes, and all of a sudden you just come and you knock them all the way flush to the ground, which lilacs like. The common lilac loves that
yeah.
to happen.
Yeah.
About every 7 to 8 years, it's a good thing to do because they'll bloom better and be stronger. But it can be a shock to the system because now you're looking at your neighbor, or you're looking at a road, or you're looking at something that you didn't necessarily want to be looking at all summer long. But over the course of a season, it'll grow back.
Yeah.
So.
But a couple of other, besides lilac, I mean, you know, you have a nasty big old forsythia that's just way outgrown. It's one of the plants that I truly loathe, by the way, and I don't want one. I don't have one. But at any rate, there's certain sort of fast growers, gangly growers that are good for the sort of once take it down and let it redo itself. Name some other ones that are good for rejuvenation.
Exactly. Like a honeysuckle shrub would do
right.
the same thing. Things that really start to go wild, and especially if you've neglected them for a while and they've really lost their form, even a viburnum is something that you could do if it's really sort of
I've gone, done viburnums. I've done physocarpus, you know, the mm-hmm. nine bark. I've done them sometimes multiple times. I've done them in some I have over 20 something years old, really big old guys, and
yeah.
they come back, you know, they just come back.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that gardeners need to, you know, newer gardeners or people who maybe are a little bit afraid of doing something like that, they need to understand that if the plant has been there for a long time, if it's been there 5, 10, 15, 20 years, it has a really good, strong root system.
Yeah.
That can bring it right back.
Yeah.
And so, you know, because I talk a lot about balancing the roots and the shoots when I
yes.
talk about, you know, caring for plants. We're responsible for the roots just as much as we're responsible for the shoots. But if the top of that plant is going crazy and it's really healthy and really strong and doing really well, that means you have really good roots under there. And so you can
yeah.
rely on those to push that new growth back.
Yeah.
It's going to work.
Yeah. Yeah, I've done white gelas too a number
oh,
of
yeah.
times. That's an easy
totally.
One.
Yeah. Totally. People do need to be a little bit careful about conifers and certain evergreens. They, like a juniper, isn't going to do that. It's not going to come back. You cut a juniper back like that, that's pretty much the end of that particular plant.
But a yew would come back, wouldn't it?
But a yew would come back.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, that's why another little slogan that I have is pruning is easy to learn but difficult to master. In other words, you need to do a little bit of research on the plant.
Definitely,
you're
definitely,
yeah,
definitely.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So composting, yay!
Yay!
So we're all going to start our spring cleanup. We're going to generate tons of organic material. Where is it going to go? And you really have a different slant on composting, a very clear, you know, you have some great tactics. So just quickly before we get into your pits, because you have these sort of three pits that you describe and show pictures of, but like there are other things like a tumbler, a bin, an open pile. Mm-hmm. Like what are those good for or not good for quickly?
The tumbler is good for really for maybe urban gardening or
yeah.
if you want to compost on a terrace or a deck and you have limited amounts of things. It's not a big garden space with
yeah.
lots of clippings and lots of cuttings because they are limited. The kind of tumbler that you want is a dual tumbler is the best one, because the trick with tumblers is you can't just keep adding the browns and the greens, the nitrogen rich and carbon rich ingredients, because then you never kind of get a chance to harvest anything. You're continually putting in fresh stuff. You need to kind of fill it and then tumble it. And then when it finishes, then you can harvest it. So these dual tumblers that they have out there nowadays, or if you have room for two tumblers, that's the way where you fill one up, start tumbling, and then start filling up the second one. You can do it that way. But it's more for, I always recommend it to my more urban gardeners because they're worried about critters getting in there.
Right. You know,
certain vermin and things
and
like that.
And a bin can keep some of those critters out too, can't it? Certain of the bins are enclosed, aren't they?
Yeah, they can, but I've seen a
raccoon.
I've seen a pretty determined raccoon like lift the lid off.
I knew it was a raccoon,
yeah,
Daryl.
And I've had some students say, you know, the rats ate through it. So if you're gardening in the city,
because we
have a lot of gardeners who are gardening in New York City,
sure.
And it's kind of a different world over there. But the other bins are great. I have a bin that I use, and it's primarily for my kitchen scraps. That's mm-hmm. kind of what I focus on putting in there. If I was to put all my gardening clippings and things like that in there, it would fill too quickly.
Right.
And I would never have enough space for it. But just for kitchen scraps for a family of, you know, four or something like that, it's certainly big enough to
right.
use.
Yeah. I have an open pile of a big garden, and so my what would be called a windrow, I think. You know, and so it's about 40 feet long and, I don't know, eight feet wide, and gets very tall in the peak season. So I couldn't possibly use a bin or a tumbler. But I was fascinated, and I'd have to dig some pretty big pits for what you're doing. But I just tell us about your pit system, your three pit system, and then after that we'll get some tips about, you know, like preparing incoming materials and stuff. But how does this
sure.
pit thing work? See if you can conjure this for us without photos, which we'll have with the transcript.
Sure. Well, the pit system is kind of the lazy guy gardener's technique and related to the three bin system,
right.
I suppose, or the three, you know, where people make a bin, you know, three side-by-side bins out of chicken wire or
pallets,
you know,
old wood
pallets.
Yeah.
Even hay bales and stuff like
yes.
that, like really cool
yes.
techniques. And you just have three of these, you know, sort of bins. And so the pit method that I like to use is instead of making those bins, you basically dig a pit. And so like a 4-foot by 4-foot, maybe 2-foot deep pit is what you could start with that would certainly handle, you know, a good portion of, you know, a small garden clippings and kitchen scraps and stuff like that. And the reason I like to use the pits is it becomes a little bit more flexible because you build the bins and they're kind of there and they're sitting there and they're going to be there, you know, until they basically sort of rot and fall apart. Yeah. And, you know, because they're going to last maybe like 5-7, it depends on what you use.
Right.
But the pit method is kind of a different thing where you can kind of expand and contract it as you go. And so the first thing that you do is you dig out a pit, you know, and so you could start with 4 by 4 by 2 feet deep and you pile the soil up next to it. And then you basically start putting your nitrogen rich and your carbon rich ingredients in there. What I basically do is I put some of my, you know, kitchen scraps down, and then I sprinkle some newspaper clipping, you know, newspapers or dried leaves or something. That's my browns.
Right.
And then I take a little bit of soil from the soil that I dug out and I cover it up. And that has done a pretty good job keeping suburban critters out of it, like, you know, raccoons and dogs and rabbits and stuff like that. They tend to sort of stay out of it that way. And what I'm doing is I continue, every time I go green, brown soil, because basically the soil has all the microorganisms and all the stuff that's going to make the compost happen.
So it inoculates it.
Yeah,
and you don't need to buy a compost starter. You don't need to pay money for that.
No, that's like, don't ever buy a compost starter. Just dig some good dirt out of the garden and use that.
Right.
So it's all in there. There's billions of microbes in that. And so I keep going over and over and over, and I keep building it up until it's sort of, it's a little bit taller than the pit itself, right? It kind of goes, you know, maybe it's like a foot taller than the pit. And then when that one's full, I dig pit number two. And basically, while I'm filling pit number two, pit number one is slowly working. And the nice thing about the pits is you don't turn them because you have soil contact
right.
around all of the ingredients, right, so you don't need to turn anything. Even the bottom of the pit has soil, and the sides of the pit are soil, and you're covering it with soil. So you're doing, you're really, it's super rich in the organisms that
are
needed.
Do you water occasionally, by the way? I forgot to say that.
If it doesn't rain, I'll give it a give it a sprinkle.
Okay, yeah. But not a big deal. Okay.
No, rain tends to do it. And you want to put it in a place that's not like super duper hot and sunny.
Right.
But also not, you know, dank and shady.
Yeah.
So somewhere kind of in between. Like right off of my deck is my perfect spot, because then I can just, you know, after cooking, I can walk out there, I drop it down, you know, into the pit. I can sprinkle some, you know, shredded mail on there, and then I can take a scoop of my dirt and toss it on, and it can, I can be done in like a minute.
Right.
And so then I start building pit number two, while pit number one is biodegrading. And then by the time I finish pit number two, one isn't done yet. It's like working. It's still working, but it's starting to shrink. I can tell that it's happening because I can see it starting to shrink.
Mm-hmm.
And then I dig pit number three. And then while I'm filling, while I'm working on pit number three, by the time that gets full, or maybe if it's cycled through all the way through a whole year, because the thing, this process is slower. That's one thing to remember. It doesn't happen as quickly as a bin, or definitely not as fast as a tumbler. It's a little bit more in line with like a heap or something.
Yes,
like
that. Yes, yes.
And so if I started my pit number one in April, it's going to be ready for me, you know, the next spring. And I'll be filling pit number three over the winter, and then in the spring, in March or something like that, I'll harvest pit number one. And hopefully it coincides with the completion of pit number three. And then there we go. I start filling up pit number one.
Again.
And then,
I
can harvest pit number two sometime in the summer. So it's just like a bin system, except you're digging the pits. And what can happen is if you realize, oh my gosh, this pit's like way too big. I don't need to do 4x4. I can shrink it. So you shrink it. Or it's like, I just don't have a, you know, I don't, I'm running out. I'm filling it too fast. Make it bigger. And so it's a little bit more flexible than building the bins. When once you build it, you're kind of stuck with whatever size.
Yes, and then they rot.
And then they rot.
Yeah. Now, do you chop stuff off? I see a picture in the book where you've mentioned a couple times, like that you might put newspaper, or you might put junk mail or whatever. Do you shred that stuff or tear it up, or
and that's really sort of the main thing that anybody who's composting needs to understand, is the smaller the pieces, the faster it breaks down.
Right.
There's just surface area. And so the,
right,
you know, don't throw a whole apple in your composting pile, you know, chop it up a little bit. I know some people who, you know, they really go to town on it. They put it in their food processor. They put like their stuff in the food processor.
Wow. That's a lot of work.
I'm not going to do that. But you know, the smaller the pieces, the better. So I shred my, you know, any sort of junk mail and things like that, and that goes in. Or I tear up the newspaper print. Or if it's big hunks of cardboard, you really need to kind of tear that up and kind of break it down a little bit.
Well, we have a minute or so left, and I was just curious, after reading the book and so forth, what's your, because you cover a lot of different subjects, do you have a particular passion? Was there a favorite? Is there a favorite thing you like to teach the most in this whole curriculum?
Oh.
About the book, you know? Your favorite part?
I like to stress the whole, you know, gardener's intuition idea,
because
then I think that gives people permission to get out there and garden, and that's how you learn how to garden, is by gardening, is by doing it. But really, one of the most important lectures, and really the most one, I think what I might consider one of the most important chapters in the book, is the book about soil.
Yes, that's what I thought from reading it.
And we were just talking about composting.
Yeah,
and really, what ends up happening is, like, the answer to everybody's gardening question when it comes to soil-related issues is typically compost.
Yes.
Whether adding compost to improve fertility, adding compost to improve water-holding ability, compost.
Yes.
But until people really, truly understand the importance of building a good, healthy garden soil, they are always going to struggle in the garden.
Yes.
And so that's that first step, because the roots and the shoots, you know, you're
just balancing, baby.
You're just as in charge of those roots.
Yes.
So give them somewhere happy to live.
Yeah.
And so really, for me, it's about the soil. And it's kind of funny, because when I took soil science in at the university, I did really badly in it.
Yeah.
I almost failed that class because I just like couldn't wrap my head around it. And
Oops.
Then it turned out to be this thing that's like the most
that's
important
your thing.
thing.
Well, that's
yeah,
what I thought.
Yeah.
That's what I inferred from reading the book. And it's the New Gardener's Handbook, Grow a Beautiful and Bountiful Garden. Our guest has been Daryl Byers. And we're going to have a book giveaway with the transcript. And we're going to have pictures of how that pit method works and other things from the book. Thank you so much for making the time. And I hope we'll talk again soon.
Oh, thank you, Margaret. Uh-huh. I'd love to talk again soon.
Programming and underwriting support from Garden Tool Company. Garden Tool Company's wide selection of heirloom quality tools for your gardening passion is backed by outstanding customer service, fast shipping, and ongoing support. GardenToolCompany.com.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and Instagram as at awaytogarden. Happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.